Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim Elshai.
Hey, Tim, we've got a great guest here, John Solomon, who is the head of research for the Aspen Institute. Aspen Institute is the not-for-profit that runs, among many things, Project Play, which is all about increasing accessibility of youth sports in communities across North America. So let's bring John Solomon on, talk a little bit about what Project Play is doing, and actually some of the follow-up, some of the ripples that may have come out of the World Cup here in New York State as well. So with that, let's go to John Solomon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Tim and I often reference the Aspen Institute and Project Play in a lot of our programs. So we figured, you know something, it's about time we go right to the source. But first of all, if you could give our listeners and our viewers really a little bit more background on the Aspen Institute as well as Project Play.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the research director with the Aspen Institute Project Play Initiative. We're a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C., focused on growing youth sports participation for all children, given the very many challenges that exist and then many children are getting left behind based on income or ability. So we do a lot of research. We identify, you know, what trends are happening both around the country, and we go into some specific communities around the country to do state of play community reports. And then we also convene people and often looking for solutions, right? It's one thing to identify some of the problems and some of the challenges, but also what are some things out there that are working, or what are ideas that could improve youth sports participation and physical activity for kids?
We talk a lot about how important participation in youth sports is for the development of our youth. You know, can you talk a little bit about just how important it is for the, you know, the development of these kids, interpersonal skills, life skills?
Yeah, I mean, we know there's lots of research out there showing that physically active children have better physical health, better, you know, emotional and social mm-hmm. health. They're more likely to do better academically, more likely to go to college, more likely to report higher self-esteem and lower depression rates. And this can track all the way into, you know, adulthood as well. And then they could potentially be active parents who then pass that on to their children as well. So there are so many physical, emotional, social benefits that come from being physically active and that can come from playing sports. And I think it's an important qualifier to say that just because you play sports doesn't mean that you will get all of these benefits that we're talking about. It's all in the delivery, which means it's all in how the program is administered, but most importantly, how it's coached, right? Like a good coach can make or break the child's experience. And so if it's a positive experience, then children can definitely receive a lot of these benefits. But unfortunately, sometimes the opposite can be true as well, that this is a negative experience, not only maybe not getting the benefits, but it could be harming you as well.
John, you are now hitting on another theme that John Simperman and I hit on. Oh my gosh, it must be every week, every couple of weeks. I feel like we're always talking at every level, from pro to amateur, how important great coaching is. You've had the opportunity to really research this and dig into it. What is your take on it? What does great, effective coaching really look like?
Couple things. One, I would say that it's age appropriate. You are teaching children at the right ages. It sounds really basic and simple, but it kind of means let's not treat our children like mini adults or mini professional athletes. When they're age 8 or 9 or 10, let's be communicating with them and teaching them the right skills at that appropriate age and have the right expectations for what they should be able to accomplish at that age. And then obviously be increasing the you know, skill development as they get older and as they get better. Second, I think it's just really important that coaches can communicate with children and just get to know them, like on a personal level. I think children believe in themselves more when there are adults who show confidence in them, meaning that we're not just playing only the best players, but we're allowing children, particularly at younger ages, to make mistakes. And that doesn't mean that they're benched for the rest of the game or play, you know, considerably less. At Project Play, you know, one recommendation that we have is that all children should receive equal playing time until at least the age of 12, right? Let them be able to make mistakes and grow and develop. And then one other initial point, and we can dive deeper into all this, but like, we just need more coaches in general, right? It's very hard to find coaches these days and people who want to volunteer, and getting them trained in some of the basics, whether it's health and safety, such as like CPR, concussion, and even just being able to communicate with kids and understand some of the mental health challenges that kids are facing these days. Not that coaches should become clinicians and should be able to, you know, diagnose children, but identify warning signs and red flags that they may know, you know, what to do with it.
And John, you know, what is your role, or what is Project Play's role in helping communities identify potential coaches, recruit potential coaches, as well as train potential coaches?
So we don't go into communities, and we're not really sort of in the ground level like that, where we would be implementing coach training and identifying coaches. We come into communities, and for our State of Play community reports, we do year-round assessment of the youth sports and physical activity space for children in that particular community. And so it's really kind of taking a look at the bigger picture of what's happening, often through like a lens of system levels approaches, like, are the systems working? How could systems be improved there? When we go into communities, we also have a very big part of our work is surveying children about their experiences. This is really vital to have youth voice, because it's their experience after all, not adults. And this sort of helps identify as well some of the challenges perhaps they are having with coaches, or what sports they want to play, or what sports they currently are playing, and just sort of what their overall experience is like. We also do some focus groups with coaches when we go into communities, as well as with young people and parents and administrators. And so that can sort of assess a little bit what the state of coaching is in a particular community.
John, what are you finding, you know, about the supply of great coaches, or would, you know, aspiring great coaches out there? I imagine a lot of, as you're saying, a lot of training is needed, a lot of recruitment is needed. You know, there are a lot of people out there who love sports, and I'm guessing not all of them are necessarily equipped to become great coaches. So what's the pipeline look like right now?
Yeah, it's challenging. You know, anecdotally, you hear that from many people across the country. It's hard in general to get people to volunteer these days, not just sports. And often that is what youth sports coaching is. If you get to a more competitive level, particularly like at the school level, yes, it usually comes with a stipend or some type of pay. If you are on a travel team, that can really include a lot of pay. That can be coaches' livelihoods. So it sort of depends what bucket you're talking about. But to find volunteer coaches can be really challenging. And it's in part because decline of volunteerism. But also, I think there are a lot of parents who don't feel like they can even be a coach, like, even if they're aware of a sport and have played it, or they don't know how to communicate with children, or maybe have no interest in doing that. So there's a need for really leaning in, I think, more into technology about how to give parents the tools to feel more comfortable to be able to coach. There's no shortage of like coaching frameworks and great coaching tips out there, whether on YouTube or National Governing Bodies of Sports or USOPC or Project Play. We have a lot of great resources, but it's often, you know, PDFs, or it's very hard to find, or people aren't aware of it. So I think there's potential solutions of leaning more into technology, perhaps even with AI, of giving people tools directly to them that they can utilize.
Yeah. We're with John Solomon, the Director of Research at the Aspen Institute. John, I wanted to kind of segue a little bit more now on the youth and the participation. And, you know, doing a lot of homework on Project Play, the 6330 initiative. If you could give us some background on 6330, and then quite frankly, where we stand now on reaching that goal.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's called, it's an initiative with Project Play called 63 by 30. And it comes from the idea, a federal government goal here in recent years, to have 63% of children participating in organized sports by the year 2030. Hence, 63% by the year 2030, 63 by 30. As of 2024, which is the most recent data, 58% of youth were participating in sports. And that went up. It was around 55% or so a year earlier. It was even a little bit lower than that during the pandemic, of course, when sports were shut down. And so that's positive that this increase has happened, because there was no given that it would. During the Great Recession, which was the last time there was, you know, a dramatic national, you know, crisis, and particularly economic crisis, participation went down and stayed down quite a bit for a while in 2008, 2009. So to see it bounce back up quickly through COVID is very important after COVID. But if you look deeper into some of the gaps that exist by demographic, boys still playing sports more than girls, white children still playing sports more than Black children and Hispanic children. And perhaps the biggest predictor of youth sports participation is household income, right? The children from the highest income homes are about two times more likely than children from the lowest income homes to play organized sports. And so those are gaps that still need to be filled.
John, that, you know, that income gap that we're seeing, my gut is that seems to be getting worse and worse just as we look at the privatization of youth sports. But what's the reality of that?
Yeah, it's getting worse. And we're going to be having some new data coming out in the fall from Sports and Fitness Industry Association, SFIA, a different data set, but showing that gap is widening as well. I think you're right that the privatization of youth sports has only increased. It's only become more commercialized, particularly, I'd say, since about 2022, since coming out of the pandemic and that sort of recovery period. The lowest income children are playing sports less. The highest income children are playing sports more.
John, you brought up privatization, and Tim and I often talk about private equity. And I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole because we could spend an entire episode on it. But, you know, what do you see as private equity's role in youth sports? What are the biggest potential negatives? And are there any potential upsides?
Yeah, so I mean, increasingly private equity has been investing more into youth sports properties, meaning leagues or, you know, organizations or, you know, tournaments or, you know, entities, those types of things. It's sort of has accelerated the privatization of youth sports. I mean, look, the challenges that are happening in youth sports in terms of how much money it's costing families, how much time it's costing families, the pressure that's put on families. This existed well before private equity came into the space. It has probably just ramped it up. You know, increasingly, families who are part of any type of private sports organization are looking around and trying to understand and wonder, how are we going to pay for this? Are there more affordable, local quality opportunities where we live to participate in sports, or is this just the reality and it's only going to get worse and worse? We have some data from 2024 from a national survey of youth sports parents showing that their average cost that they spent on their child's primary sport increased by 46% from 5 years earlier. And that was from 2024. I can only imagine what it's like today.
John, do you have a sense of what's motivating parents to spend this type of money on their kid playing a game?
Yeah, I mean, we've done some research on this. For starters, I mean, just taking a step back, I don't really blame most parents for what's happening in youth sports and for the amount of money or kind of how crazy it gets. Now, we do see some crazy youth sports parents, right? We've all sort of probably encountered them or seen the viral videos. But for the most part, they are walking into a very unregulated, confusing, highly expensive system, and they're just following what everyone else is doing, right? And so they're hearing word of mouth, or just seeing this is where you go play. Parents want what's best for their child, whether it's in sports or whether it's in, you know, theater or music or academics or what have you. And so for the vast majority, I think many parents just want to give their children the best chance to succeed, however you may define succeed. Increasingly, for a lot of parents, succeeding means just having their child make their high school team, much less the much longer odds of playing college sports or even longer odds of playing professional sports. In certain communities, and again, it depends where you live, but particularly in more suburban or affluent communities, it can be really hard to have your child make a high school team if they haven't been playing that particular sport and getting the right competition and right training at early ages, even though we know that early sports specialization has a lot of risk, overuse injuries and burnout. And so parents are increasingly investing more and more. Some of them do hope for, you know, a return on investment. I mean, the college admissions process, trying to get special access to be admitted, college scholarships, those are all part of it. When we survey youth sports parents nationally in 2024, and one of the questions we asked was, what's the highest level you think your child can eventually play in sports? And about 20% said Division I college sports, and about 10 or 11% said professional sports or the Olympics or a national team. We know that's not going to happen, right? The statistics don't bear that out. But that is the mindset of some parents, and that sort of ratchets up some of the pressure and costs for everyone.
John, this is a great segue to the research study that you conducted recently, I think New York, New Jersey. And there was a difference in priorities on why the kids participate versus why the parents participate, right? Can you walk us through what's in the mind of a child competing or playing, the better word is playing, and a parent getting them involved in that sport?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we did, the report you're talking about is our State of Soccer New York City, North Jersey report that came out recently. And it was our first report looking at in a specific community in a specific sport. And so we looked at soccer. But really, what I'm going to say applies to almost any community we're in and also any sport that you're in. And that is, when we survey children and ask them, what are the biggest reasons why you play sports? Or in this case, why you play soccer? By far, the top reasons are having fun and playing with friends. And it's not even close. Developing skills also usually ranks kind of high. And in some cases, that's, you know, a very high number three. But those top two are consistent. And it came out in our national survey of youth as well. Ranking much lower is winning games and chasing college scholarships. Yet the youth sports system designed by adults, meaning parents, coaches, administrators, is often the total opposite, right? We're not actually listening to what children are saying, what they want and what they need. And it's designed to be highly competitive, highly expensive, and not developmentally appropriate at young ages. So of course, it's not necessarily going to be fun, or of course, children are going to get priced out of it and not be able to play, or not be able to have transportation to attend all these practices and games. And so there really is this disconnect between either what adults want or what they think children want versus what children actually say that they want. And this doesn't mean that youth sports shouldn't be competitive and there shouldn't be like aspects of trying to win and trying to, you know, obtain a college scholarship. But it's all about just putting the appropriate balance and recognizing that the vast majority of these children are not going to play in college, are not going to play professionally, and they are telling us why they want to play. And it's really for the social reasons and having fun and playing with friends. And, you know, they probably can't articulate it, but the mental health reasons as well, too, just sort of getting away from maybe other problems happening in their lives.
John, does your research show, or even just your interactions with parents, it might be outside the research, but just anecdotal interactions, show that there's a pretty big disconnect between what parents' belief in their child, which is sweet, you know, thinking that, yes, they can play the NCAA any level, but D1 or Olympics or professional, versus like having any understanding of just how hard that actually is?
I think there is a disconnect. I mean, we don't have any specific stats to that point other than the one that I mentioned, right? Where like, wait, 20% thinking college, 10% thinking pro, like we know the odds are different, but I don't know how many parents actually know what the odds actually are and how long they are for college and professional. Also, now you throw an NIL into this mix as well, too, in college sports. And that, of course, has trickle down to the high school level and even to younger levels as well, where all of a sudden families have the opportunity to correctly or incorrectly view their children as potentially some moneymakers based off their name, image, and likeness, NIL, where they can receive endorsement money even before they're college athletes. So there's lots of moving dynamics to it. And I think you're right that there is this disconnect.
Yeah, we're with John Solomon, Director of Research at the Aspen Institute. John, kind of taking a step back, and I'm probably dating myself, and maybe Tim, you were in the same camp as me, but we would go to the park, or we would find a frozen pond, throw our sticks in the middle, and play a game. There were no adults. Be home by dark. Go have fun. John, where did this stop? Where did this end? Where did this era of pick-up play change?
I'm with you. Yeah, I had the same experience growing up, right? I'll date myself, and I'm almost age 50 coming up, and growing up in the 1980s, early 1990s, you would play with friends for all hours of the day, playing pickup basketball or street hockey or wiffle ball or football until it was dark or until your mom came and got you and said, it's dinner time and you have to come home. What's changed? A couple things. One, for starters, I think it is really important to say that there are some communities where you simply can't do that, right? You can't play outside and it wouldn't be safe due to, you know, violence or crime, you know, that may occur, or there may not even be safe or accessible fields for you to go play nearby that you can even walk to or bike to. So that's one. I do think there, you know, increasingly in over many years, there has been more fear among some parents about letting their children play outside, you know, on their own, even in communities where the crime rates may not be as high. But the biggest thing, I think, is just how structured our children's lives have become in all aspects, right? Of course, definitely in sports, like we're talking about, but, you know, we could be talking about academics or music or theater and all types of, you know, training or assistance or tutoring. For youth sports, this means that children's first experiences or early experiences, maybe not necessarily first, but too often are in very organized, structured settings, and that's all they know. So all they know is the coach who is running them through certain drills and, you know, trying to keep them on task, and that might not always be fun, right? And we know from lots of research that if we let children develop and learn sports on their own terms, they're more likely to continue playing and having fun and just finding that joy of sports. And in many other countries, just taking soccer as an example, because we talked about the soccer report and we're just coming off the World Cup, and the U.S. had a very disappointing performance when they got knocked out. In almost any other country around the world, it's so easy to just go play pickup soccer. You find a ball, even a makeshift ball. You find some grass or dirt, you put some makeshift goals up, you have some friends, and you play. And in the U.S., it is just highly structured, and you just don't see kids playing pickup soccer, not as much pickup basketball. It's unfortunate. I also think there are kids who don't even know how to play pickup sports on their own, meaning how do you even go start these games with friends? How do you organize it? How do you call your own like fouls, you know, or, you know, penalties? How do you settle disputes, right? And like, that's some of the value of pickup sports as well, that you learn things about yourself and others.
Do you think there's any chance, John, of recapturing any of this? Because yes, John Simperman, like you, I was riding my bike to a playground and playing baseball, you know, but no, my kids did not. Admittedly, my kids didn't do it. I'm wondering if my grandkids might one day.
I mean, I hope so. I haven't given up on it, but we probably have to be really intentional about it, right? Like, I don't think it feels like almost a generation has passed, and many kids aren't going to just find this on their own. So it almost has to be, and you do see this sometimes of like, all right, this is a sandlot baseball day, and you have parents who organize this, or maybe the coach of a team organizes it, and kids, we'll be here as adults, just, you know, on the side, just, you know, here, you know, monitoring if need be, but you are on your own. And here's how you go create like a pickup baseball game or, you know, a pickup soccer game. I think, you know, we may need to see that in practice structures more, you know, within the team setting for people to understand, or some type of organized structure. So this is just even exposed and introduced to kids.
It's as I drive by these empty ball fields, you know, these empty tennis courts in the middle of summer, I just scratch my head and say, you know, I wish the kids would just get out there and play without the parental prodding, if you will. So I do hope we find a way to get back to that. John, how much of this, though, might be tied to some of the funding that, you know, community parks and recs departments have lost? I mean, how does that tie into this now structured commercialization of sport?
Yeah, it's a big part of it. So, you know, taking a step back, I, you know, mentioned earlier about the Great Recession. I'd say around that time, again, 2008, 2009, the economy tanks, a lot of people are hurting financially, municipalities are hurting as well. And often when there are financial constraints, parks and rec departments become one of the first casualties. And so in many parks and rec departments around the country, there were hits, their budgets took a hit. And in some cases, they've never really recovered, and it's become less and less. There are some parks and rec departments still doing, you know, really good work and good programming. But in general, broadly, parks and rec departments are offering less programming than they once did. They still are the owner and the facilitator sometimes of the particular program. Maybe they partner with a private organization or a nonprofit, and they are the owner often of the facilities, the gyms, the fields, you know, and, mm-hmm. and so forth. But the actual programming is less and less by them. So as that's happened, many families have looked at the experience in Parks and Rec and wondered, well, I don't perceive this as being that good. Sometimes that's correct. Sometimes it's probably unfair how they perceive it. But they decide, I'm going to go and start my own team, or we're going to go somewhere else as well. And so the decline in public dollars and public investment in Parks and Rec departments has meant the increase of privatization. And it sort of has become this vicious cycle where as more and more families then move to the travel sports route at younger and younger ages, that leaves a more debilitated product at the parks and rec departments. In some cases, I want to generalize and say all, meaning that there's less number of children playing. They may come from lower household incomes, so you just have less money that's being paid into it. You also may have less human capacity to help, fewer volunteers to coach or administer or referee. And so all of this sort of has led to this greater mass exodus from public community-based sports to privatized sports.
John, you noted that here in the United States, youth sports are very structured, but are there other countries that have a model that we could look to?
Yeah, I mean, the one model that we talk about quite a bit at Project Play is Norway. And so Norway is a country of only about 5 million people. They, in recent years, have embraced children's rights in sports. And this has gone back actually a couple decades, meaning that at younger ages, they sort of create this protective zone around kids. There's no keeping score of games until certain ages. There's no, you know, regional or national championships until certain ages. There are all these policies that are about age development appropriate instruction and play, the joy of sports, and they tie enforcement mechanisms around it, and also tie, you know, financial dollars around this area as well. And Norway has excelled now at the Olympics, at the World Cup. Their men's soccer team just made a deep run. They are winning the gold medals in the Winter Olympics every year. They're doing better in Summer Olympics as well. So it's not that like Norway is not competitive. It's just they have realized correctly that if you don't find a way to keep your best athletes continuing to play sports at younger ages, if they're dropping out because of money or because they believe they're not good enough or pressure, then how are you going to have your best athletes much later to compete at the international stage? And so, Norway is one model that, could be explored. We're a different country than Norway, of course. We have far more people, but it also could be explored within specific states or counties or cities within the U.S., even if it never became a U.S. model.
Yeah, right. I wonder, you know, hearing you say that too, I'm wondering, like, from governor to governor, at least state to state, as you're saying, or city or county to, you know, to the next community, you know, what kind of leadership does it take? I mean, is this something, and I'm not asking you to get political here, but just structurally in terms of who has their hands on the right levers of power, is this something that governors would be wise to look at, or legislatures? Is this something mayors or county executives can look at?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say all of the above. In particular, in recent years, there's been a couple state youth sports commissions that have been created. One in Illinois, California has explored it as well. Taking a step back, I mean, the youth sports in the U.S., I think it's really important for people to understand, is highly unregulated. And this isn't a call that, like, for youth sports to become incredibly regulated. It's just to put actual guardrails and some enforcement mechanisms around what's become a very highly commercialized industry. And so, you know, one way that people can also do this is we have a Project Play developed several years ago, something called the Children's Bill of Rights in Sports. This sort of recognizes that the human rights of children is really important to closing gaps in the availability and the quality of sports programs, right? So, like, there are 8 rights in the Children's Bill of Rights in Sports, and it follows sort of the model that we talked about with Norway. Children have the right to play sports, to safe and healthy environments, to qualified program leaders, to developmentally appropriate play, to an equal opportunity for personal growth, to be treated with dignity, and then just to enjoy themselves, to have fun. And so we've had more than 600 people and organizations and municipalities endorse the Children's Bill of Rights in recent years. And some, including cities and counties, are using it to try to promote it within their community and potentially create criteria around what policies could look like for youth sports, using this sort of as guardrails, per se.
John, as we look to wrap up here, I wanted to touch on, now that the World Cup is behind us, you did a really comprehensive kind of state of soccer research study in New York, New Jersey. Can you just walk through what we found there? But more importantly, are there any positive outcomes that we think can occur based upon what you found and what we experienced with the World Cup?
Couple things. One, and some of the things that we already talked about earlier, but the fun gap, right? That children play soccer primarily for social reasons, valuing the friends, fun, skill building over winning and scholarships. And one thing that was interesting is that rec soccer players and travel soccer players shared similar motivations, right? Social factors ranked high for both. Doesn't matter what competitive level that you're talking about. So that's really important, that when we talk about travel sports, it's often the case that your travel sport child actually is playing sports for the same reasons as the rec sport child as well. And there really aren't the differences as big as you may think. Costs, of course, being a really primary barrier. That was another big finding. Nearly 1/3 of the youth soccer players that we surveyed cited that expensive team fees were a major issue. And that climbed even higher for children from the low-income households. We also showed that in the report that there were soccer deserts and infrastructure shortages. This is particularly the case when we're talking about a more urban and very highly densely populated area like New York City and some of that areas as well. But there needs to be not just more fields, but more creative spaces as well, whether it's mini pitches or street soccer parks. And some organizations are starting to making even more investments into that in the New York City area. The Tisch Illumination Fund, which was the funder of our report, has invested into street soccer parks in Queens. And then the other thing I would say that also stood out was the gender disparity in participation in soccer, that girls, for instance, represented only 38% of high school soccer players in New York City and 42% in North Jersey. And that was both below the national average of 45%. So there's a lot of information in there and some potential recommendations and solutions as well, too.
Yeah, it seems, John, that I guess I would say the lack of success we had in the World Cup as compared to many smaller nations, really, at least what I heard coming out of the World Cup, whether it was from former Olympic, or I should say World Cup players on the U.S., this might be a wake-up call because we're not getting the best players playing soccer here in the United States. So maybe that our lack of advancement on the national stage is maybe a rallying cry to make changes.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. soccer has, they are putting forth like a framework and strategies about how to improve, you know, this so-called pay-to-play model in the U.S. You'll hear no argument from them that it's a major challenge. One of the biggest challenges is that it's so unregulated and it's kind of the wild, wild west. And there's not, you know, necessarily one entity that can have control over all of this to have the policies in place to reduce the costs. It's a very confusing system, our U.S. youth soccer system, with lots mm-hmm. of different alphabet soup organizations. And it's confusing for families even to know, like, what's the right pathway for my child and the right competitive level. And so to bring all of those organizations under like one umbrella or better understanding is going to be challenging.
John, I've got to think, you know, at least some kids are, probably many, are making a choice with their families, like, you know, do I play soccer or do I go specialize in another sport? And spinning off of that, I would love your take on specialization versus generalization, you know, when it comes to kids playing sports. I've heard the arguments for both, but I'm wondering what your research shows is best for kids.
I imagine, I'm curious what you've heard, that the argument for early, and I think maybe it's important to say early sports specialization, right? Because there's definitely could be a point, particularly if you get to maybe later middle school, particularly high school, where you may start really wanting to specialize in a sport more if you're better at it. Maybe that's where your future is, or that's what you enjoy more. Although there's still a lot of value, I still think, in multi-sport sampling. But I suspect what you hear from some parents about why they have to specialize at a young age is, we have to keep up with everyone else. And it's the only way for them to play at the right competitive level, to develop the right skills, to be seen by the right coaches, to make the high school team or the college team or so on. And I would counter and say, yes, we have heard those stories of the kids who make it to college or make the high school team, but we often don't hear the stories of the kids who flame out after specializing in sports at really young ages. There is research, lots of research, that shows that early sports specialization increases the risk of burnout, increases the risk of overuse injuries, right? If you are playing baseball as an 8, 9, 10-year-old, 10 to 12 months out of the year, that's a lot of wear and tear on your arm. It's probably in large part why we see so many pitching injuries right now in Major League Baseball. Many of these pitchers have been damaged goods from a very young age, and they've had one or two Tommy John surgeries already on their elbow. And so we believe at Project Play in encouraging sports sampling and not having children pick one sport before they've grown into their bodies, they've grown into their minds, they've grown into their interests. Because what happens if, say, your child is and he reaches 10 and about 11 years old, and 11 years old is roughly about the time average age a child quits a sport, and they get to 11 and they're now hurt and can't throw a baseball anymore, or they're just burned out and don't like baseball anymore. And if they haven't been playing other sports or been exposed to other sports, how do they continue playing sports? And most likely they don't. They move on to something else, and they're not getting that physical activity and all those benefits that we talk about.
And as you mentioned, you know, their priority was social and their priority was having fun. Their priority was hanging out with their friends. And if you lose those other avenues, you lose all those benefits.
Absolutely. So,
John Solomon, Director of Research at the Aspen Institute, want to thank you for joining us today. And more importantly, I really want to thank you and Project Play for all the great work you do to get more kids out there having fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, John.
Tim, we talked. I think we checked every box that we wanted to cover with John. It's been so many times we talk about Project Play and we refer to Project Play, but it was really great to go right to the source to hear about their priorities and the work they're doing to help address some of the issues in youth sports.
And the research, John, behind those issues, you know, and I,
yeah,
you know me, I'm a nerd, and I want to hear, yeah, what is your research showing? What are, anecdotally, as you're talking to people, what are you hearing, right? And I was sitting there, and you brought it up, you put my head here. It sent me back to being 12 years old and getting on my bike every day and riding across the neighborhood to a playground, baseball bat balanced on the handlebars, and just being there all day. And I keep thinking, what can we do, you know, as a society, as a community, whatever our community is, to just encourage a little bit more of that? I know we're not going to go back to that being like the prevalent thing, but what could be created, right? And to me, that feels like the big challenge.
What's surprising to me is, I mean, you remember all the stories of, you know, Manny Ramirez, you know, Boston Red Sox, Cleveland Indian at the time, you know, he grew up playing baseball in the streets in New York City, stickball, right?
Right.
You know, you look at players like Messi and a lot of these international soccer stars, you know, they grew up in underprivileged neighborhoods, but they found a place to play, right? Think of all the great NBA players that started on the streets, right? In New York City, in Harlem. And it just seems like we're not hearing those stories anymore. We're hearing about these players that, you know, have been, you know, kind of molded, you know, from the time they're 8 years old to where they are now. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, where that all changed. What was that catalyst? And I guess maybe you're the case study. You said you were out on your bike. You would take your bat and your ball to the local sandlot, but your kids didn't, really. So, you know, kind of what was the change? What was the change for you?
Yeah, John, I'm sitting here thinking about that. Part of it, I think, was phones. So much of kids' entertainment in around 2000, somewhere between like 2006 or 7 and 2011 or 12, right? Somewhere in there, that became the form, you know, the form of entertainment and communication. That was a big one. I want to say video games, but we had video games too. It was primitive. It was Atari. It was Super Mario Brothers on Nintendo. But, you know, those were there. So it's not just, you know, kids sitting back playing video games. It's not just that. You know, I think it's being immersed on those phones. But then also think about social media and influencers. And I'm condensing a couple of decades together here. Seeing what other people are doing, not just what your neighbors are doing to get their kid that high level sports training, but looking on your phone and getting advertisements for it. And then all of a sudden you have families who can afford it or who can stretch to afford it, feeling like this is what you need to do to be a good parent. Not send my kid off to, not let my kid go off to a playground unsupervised. So there are a lot of layers to this. That's my quick pitch on what's going on though.
No, I think those are all valid reasons, you know, and I think there's this peer pressure among parents, right? There's this fear of missing out, right? If the kid down the street's in this elite program and my kid's playing in a house league, you know, how much of an advantage are they getting? The irony is, and I think we talked on this in a number of our programs, it's not always the best kids that are playing in these elite travel teams. It's the kids whose parents can write the check to be on the elite travel team. So that's unfortunate, but that is the truth. And that's what our guest John Solomon brought up, is this wealth gap with the haves and the have-nots and who's participating. And as John mentioned, you know, I think the fact that we've lost a lot of our departments of, you know, parks and recs, you know, a lot of the house leagues, whether it be hockey, baseball, soccer, basketball, all the above. So I think that is also a part of it.
And those house leagues made it a lot easier to play multiple sports too, because the commitment, you know, you committed, you were on a team, you went in, you played hard, but it was a house league. So it was a practice or two a week, a game or two a week, depending on the sport. And when the season was over and you were on to the next thing. So you could play, you know, if it's me, you could maybe play football in the fall, basketball in the winter, baseball in the spring and the summer. And then you're back to the cycle again, right? And if you drop football, maybe to focus on something else, right? And that still happens, but it doesn't happen as much. And, you know, something that was really troubling too, was what John was, to me, is what John was saying about how parents feel pressured to even help their kid make that high school team. Right. You know, that those spots are so coveted and they feel so hard to get. And these are high school teams, you know, like that's still school. That's still fun. Not that you can't take it seriously. You can. Not that you can't be competitive. You should be, right? But most schools are not preparation centers for D1 sports. There's a few that are. But for the, you know, for the most part, the varsity athlete is about as high as an athlete's going to get, right? So go in there, have fun, and then move into the next thing. And that just seems to be really disconcerting. And I didn't expect to hear that one, that high school sports are all of a sudden
almost unattainable.
It's an unattainable thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the one key takeaway as we wrap up this episode of Skin of the Game is the country of Norway has come up in 3 or 4 episodes. So I am proposing, Tim, that soon we need to take Skin of the Game on the road to Norway.
Remote from Norway. I love it. I was sitting here thinking, you know, I'm going to, you know, group a couple in here, but the Nordic countries are generally considered to be the best in education, or at least the most successful, the best in any happiness ranking and any wellness ranking. And now here in youth sports too. So something right is going on there. And yeah, I think we pack our bags and microphones and I'll leave the budget to you, John, but I'm there.
All right. And with that, we'll wrap up this episode of Skin of the Game. And again, thanks to John Solomon from the Aspen Institute for his insight and also all the great work that they're doing. Until next time.
And P.S., if any business out there wants to sponsor our trip to Norway, give us a call.
Skin of the Game is a production of Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. You can catch up with all past episodes on btpm.org or on the Buffalo, Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.